Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global forum helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. Ecosystemic Futures investigates this expansive and hyper-connected paradigm and explores frameworks to help us achieve more beneficial futures. I am your host today. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I am an economist, former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric, and prior to GE, I worked in policy and in finance. My expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today, I'm delighted to welcome him, is Professor Fiorenzo Omenetto. Fiorenzo is the Frank Double Professor of Engineering and a Professor of Biomedical Engineering at Tufts University. He also holds appointments in the Department of Physics and the Department of Electrical Engineering. His research interests are at the interface of technology, biological-inspired materials, and the natural sciences, with an emphasis on new transformative approaches for sustainable materials for high technology applications. He has proposed and pioneered the use of silk as a material platform for advanced technology with uses in photonics, optoelectronics, and nanotechnology applications. He's the co-inventor on several disclosures on the subject, around 100, and is actively investigating applications of this technology base for both technical and design applications, and we're going to be talking about it on our podcast. Fiorenzo was formerly a Robert Oppenheimer Fellow at Los Alamos National Laboratories, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a Thalberg Foundation Global Leader. He's a Fellow of the Optical Society of America and the end of the American Physical Society, and he is a senior member of SPIE. He was named one of the 50 top people in tech by Fortune magazine in a class including, among others, Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, Larry Page, Shigeru Miyamoto. His research has been featured extensively in the press with coverage in the most important media outlets worldwide. There's more to say, but I'll cut it here. Fiorenzo, Fio, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you, Marco. I'm delighted to be here.
And so our audience doesn't get confused, you and I have known each other for a little bit of time, and Fiorenzo is a very long name, so I'll shorten it to Fio. It comes more natural.
That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
Fio, this is going to be a really fascinating conversation today, because what you are doing connects the most advanced modern technology with one of the most storied and ancient manufacturing traditions. We're talking about silk. Why don't you start by telling our audience, first of all, a bit more about your professional journey and through this, how you came to this idea? Essentially, what is your silk route?
Well, I think one of the things that still surprises me to this day is that this my involvement with silk was purely by chance, and it was kind of unplanned in a way. And my professional journey starts really in electrical engineering and microelectronics, and then goes into applied physics with lasers and photonic crystals and material science, sort of in those domains. And for some reason, I was convinced by the dean of the engineering school here at Tufts, Linda Briola, that I should join a biomedical engineering department with whom I have absolutely zero cross-section of, or I should say, with which I have no cross-section. And actually, it turned out to be a very transformative choice, because the head of the department at the time was a tissue, well, was the head of the biomedical engineering department was working with tissue engineering and was working with silk as a material for a scaffold to rebuild organs. And we had a conversation in the hallway about this material, and there was a conversation about a corneal implant, and my dear colleague and friend David Kaplan showed me this little piece of transparent something that turned out to be silk. And this material had the most incredible optical properties. It was very low scattering. It had a surface roughness that was amazing. And I just noticed this because when I tried to poke some holes in it with a laser to try to make little holes on the surface of this transparent film for cells to grow into it, I lost the laser beam. There was absolutely no scattering. And so that led in a completely different direction. And so me not being a biomedical engineer, I started thinking about, well, has anybody done photonics? Has anybody done electronics? Has anybody done technical devices with this material? Because it seems like it could be interesting. And it was sort of like a side project, which then, you know, several hundreds of patents later and several hundreds of publication later became pretty much my career. And so here we are today having this conversation about probably what I hope are going to be the next many years of this class of materials that have extraordinary properties and that still to this day surprise me as we continue to build and assemble with this fiber that has been around. Well, I should say with this structural protein that has been around for thousands of years.
So let's start exactly with silk, with this amazing natural fiber. What makes it so special? What are the properties that make it so exceptional and so valuable?
I could give you the perspective when I started, which was, my gosh, this is cool. What can we do with this? Could you ever imagine that we could build optics out of something that usually is destined for ties and shirts? And so the answer evolved, because at first it was sort of like a trick. We can use this material. It's biocompatible and it has very good properties and it's very unusual. But quickly the value, I think, comes from the fact that fiber is a very technical material. One thread of silk has one third the tensile strength of stainless steel. It's very strong and very tough. And we don't use the fiber. I mean, once we have the fibers that the textile industry would use to weave clothes, we actually take the fibers and melt them down. We dissolve the fibers. And what we get at the end of the dissolution process is a precursor, is a polymeric precursor, because the building block of a silk fiber is a structural protein called fibroin. And when we clean and dissolve the fibers and recuperate that building block, essentially what we get is a liquid version of a silk that can be used like you would with a liquid precursor for petrochemical polymers. And so once you have that starting point, you can let your creativity just go wild. The one thing that is very important, though, where there is a difference, where things start to become interesting, is that precursor is a suspension of fibroin molecules in water. And so the solvent is water, which makes it a very biologically favorable environment to have functionalization that is pretty easy. A lot of things mix with water. And so you can do a lot of materials that contain very easily some dopants, so they can contain absorbers, fluorescent molecules, maybe some conducting nanoparticles, maybe some et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you start expanding the technical qualities of the material just by being sort of like a bartender and mixing a lot of cocktails starting from this solution, right? But then you have the functional attributes of the material that are that the material is edible, it's implantable, and it stores the activity of the biochemical activity of certain molecules that otherwise would have to be refrigerated. And so that opens up like an endless canvas of functional materials that you can do. And also, depending on how you assemble, how you reassemble that liquid into material formats, and then how you make the proteins come together. So how you control, for example, the relationship between inter and intramolecular bonds of the proteins, you have materials that will last for many years, or materials that will dissolve after when you pour some water on it, they will just melt away. Yeah. And you can control all of these things, all these combination properties that enable a different dimension of technology. So why is silk? Why silk is because of these functional attributes, and that's the main thing. And then you can get very much more into the weeds of how this molecule is a unique amphiphile that has been evolved through years of growing silkworms, of growing Bombyx mori caterpillars. And that molecule has some pretty favorable attributes for some of the things that we do.
It's fascinating. So you start from the observation that silk has these incredible properties, and then you turn it into liquid silk, which all of a sudden you're starting from the normal silk fibers that, as you mentioned, we know from the classic applications in clothing. You turn it into liquid silk, which then gives you a lot more flexibility in terms of what you can do with it. So why don't you tell us, what are some of the more striking applications that you have developed so far? And I'm thinking especially also, we're moving here also into some of the manufacturing, industrial, and economic applications of all this.
Yes, I think some of the most interesting applications come from these functional attributes that allow you to do things with these biomaterial based devices that you couldn't with the ordinary devices that we used to build, so with semiconductors, metals, plastics, etc. So to me, one of the first sort of surprising moments, aside from the optical properties, which was the real sort of like aha moment, but was the stabilization property, which means that, for example, if you put a drop of blood, so you imagine like this glass of water and silk, and if you put some blood in it, then you can take basically a little bit of that mixture, you pour it on the table, you let it dry, and then you come back and you lift up a plastic like sheet that is red and contains blood. And then you forget about it for 3 months. And then you come back and the sheet is still bright red. So this was this so then you start thinking about, well, what if I could manufacture different forms that have the capacity to include this function that otherwise I can't include in glass or in a seeded crystal that is doped with vacancies or in a plastic that is processed at high temperatures, etc. And so these things become very surprising. From the one hand, you could literally take a drop of your blood and put it in a little silk puck and then keep it on your table. And then after 3 weeks, you send it at the hospital, they'll dissolve the silk. And then you'll look at your blood test and the blood test will be the same as a fresh blood draw. And so you have these types of things, but then you can extend it, which is very interesting. And these are the things that we're doing now, to biologically functional inks that contain, for example, molecules that respond, that have a particular sense in chemistry. So let's not get into the sensitivity or specificity of the chemistry, but just imagine that you have a set of inks now that you can print onto a surface, on a piece of paper, onto a cloth, onto whatever, onto a wall. And you print patterns that are biologically reactive and that are kept stable because of the silk matrix that they're carried in. So at this point, you can print these patterns with different sensors, with different an enzyme maybe that changes color because of temperature, something that is pH sensitive, something that reacts to ions, something that reacts to a hormone, something that reacts to a bacteria, to E. coli, and you can print them all together, and they're just this array of dots, and now you can analyze the changes in color patterns, and so you can. Basically, with an Instagram filter, you can build physiological sensors or environmental sensors in a very cost-effective, but also very powerful way. So we had just recently an example of printing lactate oxidase to detect lactate in sweat. And it's just four different concentrations of enzymes that are in four spots. That are stabilized because they're mixed with the silk ink. And then there are reference colors around it. So there's dots of fixed colors. And then just by doing RGB analysis and using a regression model, so using AI, if you will, and lookup tables, etc., you can in real time detect physiological concentrations of lactate in your sweat, which is, and when you see the patch, it's diminutive. I mean, it's like eight circular dots on a piece of of on a tagoderm strip that you put on your arm. So these are very, this is one of the, certainly one of the surprising applications. The other.
So here you're talking about potentially quite interesting medical applications as well, right?
But I would say that it's also structural as well. I mean, it depends on what you use and how you assemble the materials. Then things evolve because you can modify the protein. You can modify, the bartender becomes better at their job. And so you mix more components and the outcomes become more functional. So there are examples where you have like inks that respond to stresses. And so you can monitor deformation of materials through color. You have inks that can sense viruses, but or toxins, and that are engineered in a lab. And so if you use de novo proteins, for example, that can sense botulin, you can have little printed tags on the top of a jar that will tell you whether the food is safe to consume or whether the toxin is present. So it goes maybe into food safety and food supply. It goes into environmental monitoring. If you have them literally placed on the wall. We have one example that we did recently of a silk sponge that we made where we put one of these de novo proteins that responds to COVID. So this protein is made to have very high specificity and sensitivity to the virus. And so we shaped this sponge in the shape of the top of a little drone that you can buy off of Amazon. And so you take, basically you have this little drone that you fly around for half an hour. The propellers take the air and continuously push it inside the silk sponge. So you sample the air in the environment, you land the drone half an hour later, and then you pop the top off and you see if there's virus in the air. So kind of like a bio canary in a coal mine, so to speak.
And with the detection technology, if you will, which is very simple and very immediate because you're relying on a very simple visual signal that we can notice and interpret very quickly.
Yes. I mean, and then it depends how sophisticated you want to go. The idea is to have something that is very, because of the patterns that you can do, the idea is to have something that is visually simple. So something as common as a thermometer. It could be very low cost. It could be very precise. It could be read with your phone. It could be just a little paper patch that you put on your skin and you just read out, and it could be ubiquitous actually and provide a good alternative to say infrared techniques or mercury thermometers.
Yeah. The classic ones. So have any of these technologies been commercially developed yet?
So our lab is a pretty entrepreneurial space.
That's a good point, Fio. I should have asked you earlier, but the Silk Lab, why don't you tell us a little bit how it's structured and what it does?
Well, so the Silk Lab was, I think, carries the memory of that first moment of surprise of when you put a laser beam on this little piece of silk and you don't see the laser beam anymore. So this surprise carries on to today. Right now, the lab is really like a combination of, it has everything that goes from prototyping, material synthesis, chemical modification, nanofabrication, materials characterization, optics and spectroscopic characterization and advanced imaging. So we go basically, we go from generation of material, optimization of the material all the way to, if you will, prototype manufacturing and device manufacturing. And I think we've had every possible walk of life come through the lab. We are not biomedical engineering limited. We have, of course, biomedical engineering students, but we've probably had every possible engineer from all engineering disciplines. We've had mathematicians, we've had computer scientists, we've had biologists, and then we had Olympic athletes, we've had architects, we've had designers, we've had musicians come through. One of the big collaborations of the lab is with a group at Berklee College of Music, for example. So it's, I think the way that the lab stands now is it's a place where it's question driven and impact driven. And because if we have the luxury of having a very versatile material platform. We have sort of like a polymath material, if you will. And I believe very much that if people want to have the shared goal that they want to have, they want to have their outcomes be meaningful and sort of like very impactful. They ask the same kinds of questions and they have the same approach to problems. So it doesn't matter who you put in the same room, they're going to speak the same language. A professional musician says that they're not an engineer, but in fact, they file their nails just so. They true their strings. They're careful about the humidity around their instrument. They have to turn their pegs in a particular way in order to have that particular tension. And so there are a lot of things and attention to detail that are shared that are put together and approach the problems that then goes, you know, into different outcomes, whether it's a beautiful song, whether it's a device, whether it's something that is very profitable. I mean, it almost doesn't matter, but having that mindset is what I try to foster within the limits and constraints of what we have to do and what we have to deliver. And so far we've had the luck that we were able to guarantee sort of like this, to enable people to come to the lab to ask questions. So it's a very, people are sometimes uncomfortable when they first get here because they have a conversation with somebody that they never expected to have a conversation with. But the process of finding the interface, I think, is very powerful. And I mean, my personal anecdote is that I think David and I found the first. So David was the head of the department at the time that I joined. And one of the things that we always joke about is that David said that I was skeptical about joining a biomedical engineering department. And David was skeptical about me joining a biomedical engineering department. And we kind of looked at each other and said, well, yeah, I mean, you're good at what you do, but why? And David said, I know for one, he's good, but I'm never going to work with him. And I think that we have, I don't know how many patents and papers we have together now. So
incredible. And that's truly the power of serendipity.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yep. What else currently, some of your commercial partnerships, have you created partnerships with established companies? What is going on?
We have interacted with corporations, but I would say that there's room to do even more. I think that every talk that we've had with large corporations, whether they were a materials engineering company or they were like a luxury conglomerate or a textile company, because there's always like this textile connection. You start from textile, so the textile world always is interested in the things that they were biomedical devices company. We were always faced with this problem of scaling up the material. After all, silk is an agricultural crop. It is a commodity. It's a commodity material. But the process of going from cocoon to liquid is something that we could do at lab scale. But then imagining these things at the industrial level is always very hard. This is one of the other connections that I think. I mean, if I may just divert for a second, this is another one of the very, very important points in my mind that sometimes is underestimated, is making, doing something amazing in the lab and making it profitable are two things that are very distant from one another. And they require the same set of commitment, the same set of attention with different contexts that sometimes academics tend to be very comfortable in the lab. And vice versa, right? So to me, that is an interface that is incredibly important. The more the two worlds talk to each other, the more innovation, the more revenue, the more opportunity you can generate. So back to us, our problem was scale up and was, how are we going to bring this to market? How much can you make? How much does it cost and how much can you make, right? So because one of the things certainly that was attractive is how this material is an alternative, for example, to plastic and to petrochemicals. So we've had this collaboration for over 8 years with a company that now is scaling up the material. And so just to give you a sense, we would make probably 50 liters of solution per year up to 5 years ago to do our things, maybe 50, maybe 100 liters of solution per year. And now the capacity is approaching something that it's closer to 100 million liters a year of solution. So And so this enables a lot, because then when you know that there's a process that is actually that somebody believes in the process and has scaled up the process, then you know that there's an answer to the question, can you scale it up and how much does it cost? And this brings me also to a second point, which is this story about alternative materials, biomaterials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like the petrochemical, the plastics versus naturally sourced, naturally derived materials and sustainability. And I think that substitution is not the answer, in fact, because plastics are really good and are very essential to a myriad of things that we do. The materials that we use today, the built materials that we use today are pretty astounding in their reliability and their mechanics and their properties and their versatility. I think that where I'm excited is that you don't want to substitute materials for a variety of reasons. I mean, first of all, it requires immense resources to even be cost competitive. And then you have to catch up technologically to performance. I believe very much in the functional aspects. This is what I love about silk, is that you have, if you will, material magic. So you have materials that can perform functions that other materials can't, which means that opens up a different set of markets and of opportunities. And I think that's the way that you win, really, because you introduce something that just simply doesn't exist today. Yeah. And so I remember in the TED talk in a long time ago, I said that you could make plastic cup substitutes so that you could throw a cup away without worrying about it, because it would be reintegrated harmlessly in the environment, right? But the detail there was that cup probably cost more than $1,000 to make. So it's absolutely a non-starter, right? But if that cup actually, every time, if you don't throw it away, and every time you pour water in, it delivers a dose of vitamins and delivers it so you can drink from it 100 times. 100 times, you'll get your electrolytes, you'll get your vitamins, or something like that. It's a different story. And so this is just a silly example of what functional surprise could be, right? What can you do if you could eat your electronics? What could you do if you could eat a coating, right? And that led to food coatings for food preservation at room temperature, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a
very interesting point, because what you're saying essentially is that what we need is a shift in how we're thinking, right? So instead of saying, well, right now we're living in a world where we are used to products that have certain properties because we started with materials that had certain physical properties. And so instead of saying, how do we preserve exactly the same properties and functionalities with a different material, let's start from the fact that we have different materials available with different properties and ask ourselves, how can we use these different properties to best meet what we want to do, what our goals are, what our needs are.
That's absolutely true. And I think that I think that silk, for a variety of reasons, and for its interface process, for its manufacturability, for the fact that now 20 years later, we can control it down to the monolayer, we can do all sorts of very sophisticated building, both from literally from the nanoscale to the macro scale. Mm-hmm. I think that silk is a very interesting bridge between the technical functions and the natural functions. And so it's a way to get the two worlds to speak to each other. So it adds value to materials that already exist, and then it builds materials on their own that could be new and could be unexpected and could be impactful, useful, remunerative. They could build different industries. So there's also a nice sort of like aspect of, if you think about, we've been around biomaterials all our life. I mean, it's not like I'm here saying, haha, I've discovered this. I mean, people have built with wood, right, for forever. But if you think about it, we've always tried to eliminate variability from our biomaterials, because if you build a table, you dry the wood, you try to take every ounce of life out of it so that its behavior will be repeatable. And in order to take away the variability that, for example, a natural material has or a biological material has, in order to take it out, you that you do these types of things. And so that led us to a lot of coatings, a lot of fillers, a lot of glues, a lot of things that will make sure that the table that that your computer is sitting on and my computer is sitting on is going to be the same table every day for as long as we use it. And I think that there's something that is very interesting in the variability that could be exploited, because biomaterials are interactive and their way of moving and their way of adapting to the environment is sort of like a biological solver in a way. And it does carry the information of what is around you. And so you can take this in multiple directions, but if you, and so this is where silk enters, it's your biological to technological interface that makes the variable tuck to the power of to the immutable, right? It's sort of like almost it's almost,
and there is perhaps a broader point here, right, Theo? Because so we are very proud always of our technological prowess and what we can do, and often we forget that nature has been tackling formidable problems over the course of millennia. So learning from how nature has tackled problems, what solutions it has developed, is probably a lot. Am I right in thinking that there is a lot more that we can do in learning from nature and borrowing and applying?
Nature is incredible. Nature is massively parallel. It uses energy efficiency. Nature is massively parallel. It uses energy efficiently. It self-heals. It's circular. It recycles. It's just amazing. And then it's unbelievably technical in certain aspects. So the fields of bioinspiration and biomimicry have been around for a long time. But I think that there's like these technological aspects that one could translate that are immensely valuable. And then it's always pretty humbling to look at these things and know that you're surrounded by, as I stare at the plant that is behind me, you're surrounded by an adaptable photosynthetic, heliotropic, light aligning sort of energy capture, right? So one of the things, for example, that we're doing is we're looking a little bit less to do with silk is we're looking at orchids that are the orchids that grow in the underbrush, that grow in the dark. And just because we like to study photonic things, they kind of have shiny leaves, and we just discovered that actually the leaf is an optical network, and so the light, instead of going through the leaf and photosynthesizing in the bulk of the leaf, the light actually comes and hits the surface of the cells, and that this optical network redistributes the light on the surface of the leaf so that it extracts energy more efficiently. And so these are things that, if you think about things that people wanted to do with solar panels, with Fresnel lenses and solar concentrators and things to enhance, or with light bulbs to distribute light efficiently, or have spectral sculpting of the wavelength of light that came out of bulbs. This is pretty amazing. And so here we are building these leaf replicas that contain photosynthetic materials to see if we can replicate these things. So
in a sense, what you're doing with silk could be just the first step towards developing a whole ecosystem, a whole world of living materials, which could open up really new possibilities, which is fantastic, because in material science, often we tend to think in terms of maybe how artificial intelligence can help us develop new materials. But here you're opening a different window, which is just looking at nature and thinking of developing new living materials, which is, and it almost has endless possibilities.
It's funny that you mentioned that has been our moniker for a long time. So in fact, we run a workshop called Living Materials. We've run it for the past decade. And I really believe that's the case. I think that in engineering, and sometimes in device engineering, you reason with design rules and mean time to failure of the device. And if you put something that is as variable as a layer of structural protein on, say, a silicon device, it's unthinkable. But I think the exciting thing is where you really get the two worlds to talk to each other. So silk is transformed with planar fabrication techniques that silicon can interface to. And so suddenly now you have two very powerful, you have almost the analog and the digital that are coming together through through biology, through the biology that you can put inside silk. So it's very exciting. As I said, 20 years after this conversation in the hallway with David, I still think that there's so much discovery and so much power that can be used for a lot of really cool things.
It's fascinating. Phil, before we wrap up, there's one more issue that I wanted to get your thoughts on, which is the nature of innovation, possibly innovation models, along two lines. One is on the podcast also our common friend, Mickey McManus, and he always argues that, look, points out that the biggest value in innovation today comes almost always at the intersection of different disciplines. So the crossover of different fields of expertise. And that seems to mirror your experience as well. The second part is first, to what extent this is relevant. And secondly, your thoughts on the right model of interaction of public and private, academia and startups, public sector, government and private sector. We're looking at it. This is an ecosystemic futures podcast. So we're always thinking in terms of how do we build ecosystems for success going forward. Based on your experience, how do you see the right ecosystems for innovation taking shape?
Call me traditionalist. I think that I'm still a fan of the Bell Lab style cafeteria and all the way back to, I guess the Legio Children model of having a shared piazza where people talk and interact. So I think I'm on the side of the intersection, but it doesn't mean necessarily that the outcome is going to be intersectional. It could be very disciplinary. I think that the intersection is, the exchange is important, then the outcome can be very pointed and it can be very dedicated to a new fab design line for something versus to radically shift and generate something new. Well, then you sort of have to, I mean, I don't know if you can even define the intersection. If it's new, the intersection doesn't exist.
So, that's a good point.
So I think the cafeteria, the square, the bar, they're very good, the dinner table, they're very good places for exchange. And in fact, I mean, the food stabilization adventure started around lunch as a joke. So I'm a very big believer in that type of environment. The other question that you had about the interplay is, I think that it's the same thing as the square. I think that there needs to be a very dynamic interaction between public, private, academic. There are pockets of competency that are incredible in all these different domains. And the important thing is the communication. Like I was alluding to this beforehand. You need the world to be aware of each other in order to function well, because when there's this spinning out is something where you almost see something go away and belong to a different world, right? And so it's fine for a set of reasons for your individual functions, but I think awareness of that transition and awareness of what it takes in all the different domains from all sides is something that is, I think, is something that is vital. I think there should be enhanced interaction between all. Where does that lead and how to configure it, I don't know. It's complex, right? Because the system has very many microcosms that exist. And so to me, the winning solution is always having a place where you have like a very connected energy that brings together the play that is necessary with the pragmatics and sort of like the awareness of where you're operating and how to form well in that context. I don't know that I answered your question.
I was looking for your thoughts and reflections. So by definition, you have answered it.
Okay, good. Because I don't know. I really don't know. It's complex to optimize this interaction. I mean, for us, there are operating from a lab, from a discovery standpoint, you look for like-minded people that want to invest in sort of like the wonder and the surprise and the return. So you need a particular type of person that is contextually aware, I should say.
Exactly. And so that is a key message for all the investors in our audience who might be interested and curious about what Fiorenzo is developing in the lab. Get in touch. Fio, this is a great place to end our conversation. It's fascinating. We've covered a lot of ground. Anything that we left out, anything that we should have mentioned, anything, any last message you want to give to our audience?
Just go and look that. I just hope that when they see a piece of silk, they never look at it the same way that they did before.
I certainly will not. Professor Fiorenzo Menetto of Tufts University. Fio, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the podcast with us.
Thank you, Marco.
And thanks everyone for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and new business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, wherever you access your podcasts, and you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.